For the fans, by the fans, this is the Non-League Football Show, and I'm Tim Fuel, back with another weekly look at the world of non-league football. A big week in football with a new government white paper. We get the thoughts of old friends of the show, fan engagement expert turned lecturer Kevin Rye, on what this, well, football governance white paper all means, especially for non-league, and how people can get involved and influence the likely legislation it is set to bring. On a slightly different note, we speak with a man who's just notched his 2000th game at his club. From assistant secretary through a variety of roles behind the scenes, Dave Phillips still runs the turnstiles now at Melksham Town on a weekend, and he's now well into his 70s. Rounding up the week's non-league news, Matt Backcock from the non-league paper, and what a week it's been too. Sit back, relax, and let's get matters underway. So then, the big news in football, clearly the government white paper, A Sustainable Future, Reforming Club Football Governance is what it's entitled. It brings forth some of the many recommendations from the Crouch Report. Much debate across the media, and probably much from those who haven't read it or maybe don't really understand how it's all likely to play out from here. So we need to bring in an expert. And who better than to recall back to the Non-League Football Show, old friend of the show, Mr. Kevin Rye. Welcome back, Kevin.
Hi, Tim. Yeah, nice to see you.
It's good to see. I let everybody into a little secret. We're on video chat as well. I've not seen Kevin's smiling face for a long while. But Kevin, this white paper, it's the next step on from the Crouch Report. Does it usher in a new era for football?
I mean, the first thing is the first time we've got to the stage where a report like this has resulted in that the full recommendations of this sort have resulted in anything quite this substantial. We did have reform. We have had reform before. I had a job at Supporters Direct essentially off the back of the first attempt at this in 1999, which was the Football Task Force, which recommended an independent regulator. But the fact that this is now on the, you know, it's now on a white paper, it's the first step in really in getting this through Parliament and into law. It's quite amazing. In one sense, it's quite amazing we're here that this is going to happen, because Labour pledged to do it anyway. So both the political parties who could form the government, one that's in government now and which could form government next time, both are pledged to do this. So it's going to happen. The other part of it is it's quite remarkable that 24 years later, from the first time it was recommended, about 7 reports later, this is now, by the way, into the way that football is run and its finance, all that. It's taken that long to get to this stage. But that's the story of how football's refused to grow up. Because I do think it is a bit like that. For me, every single time we've come to this question of how football runs itself, the sort of powerful interests have prevented that from changing. And I've gone off the subject a little bit, but the irony for me of listening to people like, say, and you know, it's not the non-league, not a non-league chairman, but someone like David Sullivan at West Ham, is that I hear him now saying that governments can't run anything. Well, it's quite funny to hear someone like him saying all of this. The Premier League have been resistant to regulation for years. The Football League was resistant to regulation until the last few years, I think, when it realised its vulnerability, particularly through COVID. But then to hear someone like Sullivan being so resistant when they had the chance to get the FA to do it, they could have let the FA do it. And then what happened about a year ago, all of a sudden the Premier League were apparently convinced, or at least some clubs, of the FA regulating, finally. But it was too late. In the end, the reason we're in this position is because too many people in football tried too many times to resist being regulated appropriately. And the government's had to do what governments have to do sometimes, which is to say, that's failing. It's an important sector. It's a protected sector because it's what we call a lot of monopolies. businesses that have a monopoly on something acting as what you call a cartel, a group of businesses operating in their own interests, and they can't do it properly. So we have to intervene. We have to correct the market. We have to change it, make it run better. Hopefully, you know, maybe there won't need to be an independent regulator in, after a period of time. Who knows? But, you know, this is inevitable when it can, when they continue doing the same thing over and over and over again, like some Einsteinian cock up.
But interesting, on that opposition side of things, one of the statements I read from the Premier League on the back of the report coming out, it said that it's vital that regulation does not damage the game that fans love to watch. And that came from the Premier League.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, it's really important. No one is going to deny that it's really important that there isn't what you call overreach. So that the regulator doesn't try too hard to, for example, let's say create two, you know, for example, you could introduce a form of financial regulation, which you call a hard cap, which caps wage spending at an absolute level, right? For every single club, the same level. That wouldn't be a good idea because then it stops clubs that say get an average of 70,000 spending more than a club that gets, say, an average of 20,000. I think that's unfair because it's about, then it's about club size. That should have a factor in it, right? But a lot of this is just sensible. And I think we've kind of, one of the major problems I have with the conversation about all of this is that we're constantly drawn away from the conversation about what does go on the pitch and about the game, to be conversing constantly about whose sovereign wealth fund or leverage buyout or even whatever model of ownership is better. What we need to have, for me, is some form of kind of equalizing and balancing out all the different types of ownership we have, all the different types of ways that clubs are run. You know, I think you're still a director at Hayes and Yedding, aren't you? You know, I think a club like Hayes and Yedding, you know, sensibly run, sensibly owned, should be able to compete alongside clubs, say, that are fan-owned, that are not fan-owned, and that we should all just have, you know, better regulation on things like who should run clubs, who should be able to take the decisions, how decisions are taken. A lot of it, and as I say, a lot of this could have been done time and again, but I'm afraid, and I don't normally say this because I don't want to go around having a pop at particular groups of people, but I'm afraid the Premier League resisted regulation repeatedly. The reason they did it was because it was not in their interest. The reason it wasn't in their interest was because the clubs were running it. And that is the reason why you need to have a regulator, and it has to be independent, because the clubs are incapable of making decisions that are about anything beyond next week, the week after, you know, if you're lucky, 3 weeks' time. And you know that too, as someone who runs a club. The pressures on you to make decisions now about now mean you have to have proper regulation. The fact that they didn't allow the FA to do it, well, tough, I'm afraid. You had your chance.
And I think from running a club, and I think you're still, still on the Don's Trust board and sort of...
I'm on the Don's Trust board now, I've just recently been elected.
It's just that insight that when you're in those positions, sometimes you just need a bit of guidance, don't you? It's almost like a tram, just so you're not going to go, because there are so many things going on that you just need to be pointed in the right direction. And I think the big thing that I'm hoping for more information that's mentioned in the white paper, and obviously the white paper is going to be fleshed out over months, hopefully not years, but who knows? The Football Club Corporate Governance Code is something that's mentioned there, and I think most of our listeners probably know what makes a good director of a football club, but I'm not always sure. Firstly, that those who become directors necessarily know, you know, what makes a good director, or the people that aren't good directors know what makes a good director, or even some of those people that would make good directors know that they would make good directors, and I think setting it down will help.
Yeah. No, I think so. I mean, I have to say I'm in the fortunate position, I would say, where I'm not actually a director of the football club. I'm in the beneficial position where I help to oversee, you know, making sure the whole thing kind of is run in the right way and that the decisions are right and all that kind of stuff, whereas you're much more at the coalface. But even for me, I think knowing how, you know, having a general view of how things should operate. How is it this, you know, because it is a really exceptionally odd business, isn't it? I mean, I caught you say business, but it is, you know.
It has to be a business in order to survive. There's pressures on it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, no, I think it's interesting you raise that. And corporate governance will send a lot of people asleep. They won't know what it means. But really, I mean, a lot of that is about, you know, what are the steps you take to ensure that the business is run in the right way, it's responsible. You know, and when I hear all these sort of people pleading, saying, you've got to leave it alone, it's a successful product and that kind of stuff. Yeah, okay, and I come back to that point. And I was making this point to a colleague today, because I also now teach at UCFB at Wembley at in football business. I was talking to a colleague today and I said, you know, the problem I have here is, and as I said to you, we cannot go and set a football club up and immediately open up in competition to a club down the road. We have to go through a process of registration with a county, get into a league, go through a process, licensing obviously exists in non-league, all those sorts of things. We are already a cosseted business that doesn't have the same pressures on it than me opening a corner shop down the road or whatever it is, most other kind of businesses, if you exempt things like gas or, you know, utilities or things, just a normal business. So we're already in a very beneficial position. So, you know, the clubs at the very, very top, they could have been Hayes and Yedding. You know, there's no, in one sense, apart from an accident of history, you know, Hayes and Yedding could well have been QPR, well, Slough Town could have been Brentford. The season we went up
out of the National South or Conference South as it was, and I think AFC Wimbledon went up as champions that season. We came up via the playoffs. That season, I think Bournemouth were 3 minutes into injury time and would have ended up playing us that following season. And that was, you know, certainly within the memory of my kids. That's how these sliding doors moments happen in football.
And that's exactly right. Exactly right. All it took was one. And it's something, you know, Arsene Wenger, even Arsene Wenger could appreciate that there was this thing called a pyramid and that we are only here because we sit at the top of the pyramid and all these other people are taking the weight, you know, are underneath us. And that's the bit, is you have to appreciate what you're in. And my advice, and obviously with what I do now, because I do a lot of work all over the industry as well as teaching and things, and appreciate what you own. If you own it, if you're fortunate enough to own this thing, just realise what it is you own and realise that it's no good carping about the fact that you have to do something that's different to what you might have to do in your ordinary business operations. You've got something here that is very special. And unfortunately, too many of your peers, even if you're good at owning your football club, too many of your peers have not been. And I'm afraid in an industry where it's collective and we to some extent rise and fall by our collective efforts, and the game is, you know, the game was in a terrible mess up to the sort of late 80s, early 90s. And we are in a renaissance, even in non-league football. You know, huge amounts of participation of clubs and participation through that of kids and of girls now and women's football clubs emerging and all this stuff. This is something we all rise and fall together on. And if one group of people are irresponsible and overspend and won't be regulated properly, that's an impact on all of us. And for me, that's the essence of this is, yeah, it's fine. If you want to glory and revel in the fact that you've made it to the top, and that you were like Bournemouth, for example, and you did get from your 3 minutes away from being in non-league football playing little old Hayes and Yedding, and in fact you are now playing in the top flight. Well, that's lucky for you, mate, but that's not what the majority of football experience. And we have to make sure that we balance that out. And like I said, every single time, I come back to the point, it's taken us, you know, the last time an independent regulator was proposed was in the late 90s. We have had something like 7 or 8 reports concerning the finance and governance and the running of the game. Every single time it's been shoved away, they haven't wanted it. And so my point is that I wasn't even convinced of an independent regulator until I realised, do you know what, actually, I'm afraid I think this is the only way it's going to work. And, you know, and I think we just have to accept it. Let's try to make it the best possible regulator we have. And look, if the Premier League and clubs who don't want to be regulated in this way want a little project for the next 5 years or so. Why don't you make it so at the end of it, the FA can properly take on a proper regulatory role, as they should be, rather than, you know, undermining what we've got coming down the road. Let's try and make the best of this, because I think we'll end up with a better game as a result.
Yeah. So it's a 99-page report. I'll share it out on social media, the PDF, so people can have a read themselves. It's not as mind-blowing or sort of mind-numbing as certain white papers have been. It seems to be three main prongs: club sustainability, systemic stability, which is, again, like you're saying, we want to be able to ensure that football's still running for years to come, and also cultural heritage. And I guess with your sort of Don's Trust Board hat on, that's probably something of particular interest to you, because that's like looking after the name, looking after stadium rights, namings, and keeping the stadium within, you know, fan ownership, or certainly not being able to be
within your area. I mean, I have to be honest, my preference is that there used to be a rule in the FA handbook, you know, in the FA rule book, which said you couldn't separate the ground from the football club, and I think when it comes to sort of protection of the stadium, that was, and if you, I think the rule was also, if you sold it, the proceeds couldn't be taken out of the football club, and the FA just allowed that to fall. I think it was connected with an existing director at that point. I think it was to do with the sale of York City at the time, Booth and Crescent at the time. And you know, I find that one, I'm not desperately keen on. I'm not as keen on that. I think we should just protect the football club stadia by making them remain in one company, for example. But look, the point of it is that you're recognising that these things, you know, unlike, you know, a company that you can rename if you fancy doing that, you can't just do that. You can't just change the badge willy-nilly. I was involved in a couple of cases, one being Hull City, and the other one being Withdean. Whitehawk. You know, and we were asked for our views when I worked for supporters directors at the time. And the point of it is, did you go and ask anyone? Did you seek permission for this? Or are you just saying, I want to change the name? Well, it's not yours to just change. So you need to, you know, consultation. Well, you need to actually get the permission of fans. So I think all that, look, as much as there are some things in there that I think could be done a slightly different way, I think the principle is,
It's progress, isn't it?
Exactly right. It's progress, massive progress.
You've already mentioned it there, the importance of the pyramid, and I'm always concerned that we might create a two-tier game. I've looked already. You know, FA Cup fifth round, we've got four VAR games and four non-VAR games, which means that we've got even at the highest level in our greatest ever cup competition, we still got a two-tier game. And I'm always concerned that this white paper mentions that elite game again, so it's mentioning down to the National League. What I don't want to see is the National League again becoming further detached from the rest of the pyramid, which is vital to it. And I guess, you know, with your knowledge and your experience, how can clubs make sure that they lobby and that whatever comes from this white paper represents
I think there is a risk that if you get this wrong, at the very least, you end up kind of chopping off the National League, and that goes with the elite game, and that then leaves everyone else adrift, and almost in a sense potentially recreates a version of sort of before the amateur semi-pro break, you know, before amateurism was essentially ditched, right, in the 70s. A bit of nerd knowledge there. And I think the positive thing of it is that actually, if it's done right, what the regulator will be able to kind of prompt, if not lead, so I don't quite know how this would work, would be, for example, when sides are relegated from League Two into the National League Premier, they won't have this cliff edge after 2 or 3 years where any money they get for their academy, particularly their academy and development, is gone and all their players are just picked off. Or, you know, or even the parachute payment that you get goes, and then you end up having to just run on what you've got down there. So it might smooth some of those bumps out. And actually, in doing that, I think what that potentially does is it stops the arms race. If you end up with a sensible decision over promotion and relegation, and clubs feel that they can, because of distribution from the Premier League, can now open up, because everyone knows we need at least three up, three down from National League Premier. I think you could even make an argument for four, but three will be fine for now. You open that up, I think that does non-league a huge amount of good, because it then just smooths out that really, I think it's an escalation when you get into the National League Premier, and it creates clubs that just bleed money all the time. So that's a good thing. I think actually the potential is there for it to actually be really good for non-league, if not directly, because that thing gets changed to the regulator, or because it gives us space to finally make those decisions about up and down between. Right. Then when it comes to actually the changes, yes, what clubs need to realise is, A, don't be scared of this stuff. So whatever big brother or big sister club down the road is telling you, this is really bad for the game, it's not. It's actually going to be good for you, I think. And it's going to be good for you because it's going to reduce that arms race, I think. You know, ultimately, it will smooth out, potential to smooth out a lot of the kinks. Part of the reason some of the people at the top don't like it, because it means they might have to lose a bit of money. But, you know, this is good. This is good stuff. This will create a way for you to be able to, you know, there won't just be this drift, which you get, and you get these periods of sort of chaos. And I'd be encouraging every club out there, and whether there are supporters organisations in there or not, you know, I'd be getting in there and talking to your local MPs and asking them to support it. Also, asking them to get more information on it. Can they help us to understand this better, please? You know, often what you'll find is the best way to do it isn't to write to the sports minister or DCMS, Culture, Media and Sport, or whatever it's called these days, because I know some of it's been taken out and moved. I think it is just CMS, DCMS again, is talk to your MP. They can talk to these departments for you. So if they need to understand, go and have a meeting at the surgery. Organise a meeting of the club. Perhaps if you're a member-owned club, you know, if you're a membership committee, or, you know, whether you've got directors or whatever you've got, organise a meeting. Go and have a surgery with your MP and go, look, I just really want to understand what this is about. Get together as a group of clubs locally. You know, we know the further down you go, the more these clubs you have. Get together as a group. Get together as a league. Go along and talk to, go along and talk to your MP and get that fed into the system. Because one thing you are right about is, yes, of course, because that big noisy game at the top, the 20 clubs at the top are the noisiest lot, right? Because they're the biggest and there's most money in it. But there are tons of clubs, hundreds of clubs further down, and they need to have a voice in this. And I would encourage them to just take the time out, work through your MP. That's what they're there for. You know, as I say, don't go direct to government. Go to your MP, talk to them, try to get them to act on your behalf, to talk to people for you, get your head around what you know, what it's about. But I think broadly welcome it, because I think it's going to be good for non-league football as much as...
For clubs, it is important for clubs to be in contact with their MP anyway, isn't it? But this, if you've not got that relationship at the moment, what a great opportunity to make that link up now.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, clubs will need local MPs during perhaps a planning process or you know, some kind of issue that they've got, perhaps, you know, locally. And it's never a good idea to leave it to that moment. Build a relationship now. I mean, I've done political communications within football and done sort of what you might call lobbying. I've done sort of local work with, if you call it stakeholder engagement work, it's something I also do sometimes. And it's really important that you get to know people like that. If you're a football club, get to know those people. And actually, they're really, you know, despite the reputation that some MPs have got themselves very deservedly for being truth twisters or what have you, there are some terrific local MPs out there, some terrific MPs full stop, who do a lot locally and will really pull their finger out for you. If you go there and you ask for help and you say, look, I just want to understand this, I want to either support it, or I want to know more, I want to lobby to get more done, more explicitly done for non-league football, or more clarity, or whatever it is, do that. And that's what they're there for in the end. They're elected by local people. They're responsible to you. You know, they have to make decisions sometimes that you might not like. They're not delegated to do what they're told. but they want to know what you think, and they, because it helps them to make the right decisions. So get out there and talk to them, build those relationships. And also, if you're particularly if you're a non-league club, you never know when that relationship might come in use at some other point in the future. So yeah, absolutely. You know, get them along to the clubhouse or whatever, and sit down with them, or go to their surgery and have a chat.
Yeah, and of course this is a white paper. So for those maybe not used to the vagaries of politics, this is just another one of the step, isn't it? I mean, it's now lots of chatting, but they're looking for they're looking for thoughts from people and sort of new ways that they can tweak this, and it might be a while before this comes into play, but it is that further step.
Yeah, exactly. This is a step along the road we've never had. We've never had this kind of intervention. It is quite controversial. I'm talking to a journalist online at the moment about this who doesn't agree with it. But we are on a road to it. It is important that it's got right. It is important that when government does something like this, that it's done properly. And it isn't over. There isn't overreach, is what you call overreach, maybe going too far. That some of the things that maybe aren't quite clear enough yet get cleared up. But look, the voice from the very powerful elements of the game, and not everyone in the Premier League is implacably opposed to this. Not everyone in the Football League will necessarily be as in favour as the league's position is. You know, there are lots of nuances out there. You need to make your voice heard in a process that is, can be very quickly... if you're not careful, your influence can disappear very fast, because influence is brought to bear very quickly through obviously the greater resources of other further up the pyramid. They have greater resources. They will be lobbying on this very hard. But look, so far, and Fair Game is a very good example. It's something I advise on policy. Fair Game campaign has a lot of non-league clubs in it. They already have made their presence felt. Some of the reason we're in the position we're in with the regulator is partly to that, because of the Fair Game campaign, because of the work we did for years at Supporters Direct, the FSF, now the Football Supporters Association. Lots of proactive MPs, lots of proactive people in the game have been pushing for this. So we're where we are because lots of what I call the progressive forces in football have been demanding this, have been pushing for it, have been creating the ideas. So they've already helped to get us this far. Another push. A bit more input and we hopefully will come up with the best possible form of regulator that we can, because in the end it'll work, because football accepts its need and accepts its utility and the usefulness of it. I think we'll be there eventually. But yeah, everyone can influence this. Get out and influence it.
And Kevin, you've already mentioned you're out lecturing at UCFB as well, and you're still doing your consultancy sort of stuff. But if people wanted to get in contact with you, how's the best way to get hold of you and sort of link up and sort of pick your brains?
All the contacts, if you go to fanengagement.net, there's everything's on there, and get in touch with me that way. And I'm, all the socials. But if you want to get hold of me directly on email, then kevin@fanengagement.net is perfectly okay. But there are, as you observed earlier, Tim, a million email addresses that you can get me on. If you have any of those, they all still work.
Kevin Ryan, always a pleasure to get you back on the Non-League Football Show. Thanks once again for your input and your knowledge. No problem, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again very soon.
Anytime, Tim. Cheers.
Now, with the rising popularity of the app and website Footballogy, more and more of our listeners, I know, keep track of the grounds and games they've been to. Not many, though, will be able to compete with my next guest. Last week, he celebrated his 2,000th game watching his beloved Melksham Town. He's not just some super fan either. He's had many roles at the club, including, I believe, secretary, vice chairman, and I understand he might even be seen helping on the turnstiles every now and then as well. To tell us more, please welcome to the Non-League Football Show, joint club president at Melksham Town, Mr. Dave Phillips. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Well, it's great to get you on, because, we love people that love non-league football, and I think at 2,000 games, you love non-league football.
I absolutely do, yes. I joined the club in 1976 as an assistant secretary, and I was away, so I missed the first two or three league games. But actually, my first game of the 2000 I've documented was an FA Cup game at Cinderford on the 18th of September 1976. And of course, the 2000s game was last Saturday when we played AFC Tottenham away.
Not a memorable game. I won't mention the result on that one.
No. Well, we actually lost the first game. During the first game at Cinderford, won each and lost the replay at Belgium on the following Tuesday night.
Your records then, they go back to, you say, 1976. Now, I remember reading when you were about, I think you were on about 1,800 games when the club first got promoted to the Southern League. Has it been a...
That is correct, yes. The Melton News, which is a local freebie paper, did an interview with me 5 years ago. Now, I probably might have reached these 2,000 games before last Saturday, but... for personal reasons, I've missed a few games in the last 5 years because I've been away looking after a friend in Essex who's, you know, a lady friend who's gone through a cancer process.
This 2000 mark, though, has always been on the horizon. I mean,
yes, indeed.
Is it something that everybody has sort of been nudging you about to try and, you know, if there's a... Has there been one day where you've had a long week, or you're maybe not feeling under the weather, and someone said, "Look, you've got to make this marker."
No, I wouldn't say I've had people doing that, but you know, I've been keen to get there. And as I say, somebody said, "How many miles have you travelled during that time?" I said, "Well, I can't possibly come up with that answer." I can actually, you know, people ask me about certain games, remember the goal scorers, the scores, etc., because I've documented it all.
I was going to ask, how much detail have you got? Have you got, like, the scores, the attendances, the teams? I mean, how far?
Well, I've got, I've been, certainly in recent years, I have a file for each season. In fact, actually, I'm not the official club historian, but I've done a lot of research into the town, and even going back over its history, right from the time it first played league football in 1894, I've got most of the results.
Wow.
These in recent seasons, I will do a file where I record every game, the scores, etc. Yeah, I keep update weekly of the first team appearances, scores, and scorers, and also I write out the teams actually with the referee attendance and the subs and the scorers.
And I understand, like myself, you did 20 odd years being that essential match reporter as well.
Was sort of press officer, and I wrote and did reports for the local freebie paper. I also used to phone up reports through to a paper in the southwest. I don't think it no longer functions, but it used to have a very good football coverage at the non-league. That was the Sunday Independent.
Yeah.
I used to ring through reports.
I remember ringing through reports for the Sunday Independent in the back in the day. Yeah.
Oh, right. That's right, yeah. And as I say, I've actually, in the course of these 2000 games, I've been as far as, obviously, I used to go to Cornwall quite regularly in the old days of the Western League, you know, places like Saltash, Liscard, Falmouth. And then I've also been, I remember 40 years ago, going to a Vales game in London, where we played mostly in the FA Vales back in 1982. And 5 years ago, I went on the longest trip we've undertaken from Norwich, where we were drawn away to Leiston in Suffolk in the FA Trophy.
That's a long way, map.
Pardon?
Even looking on a map, that's a long way.
Yes, indeed, yes, yeah. But you know, I was fortunate that when I joined the club in 76, I was assistant secretary. Mike Perrin, who's my joint club president, who also celebrates a landmark year of 60 years of service to the club, because he played as a player when he was 16. He was still playing, so I used to go to games because obviously the club needed some representation there. So I was travelling away with the first team right from the off.
And I was going to come to you, your joint president, Mike Perrin, because I mean the wealth of knowledge and experience that the two of you must have of non-league. I mean, we should. I don't know, bottle you up. We should be renting you out to other clubs so that they can learn from you.
Well, I don't know about that, but it's certainly been some week, because we were actually on Points West on the BBC local news on Monday night.
Not very nice.
Which it was a complete surprise. I didn't know anything about it until Monday morning. But Darren Perrin, who's the chairman, who's Mick's son, said I was up there. He said, "Oh, you're not going home as early as you like today, because I still help out and I'll be there Saturday doing the turnstiles." Brilliant. He said, "Because Points West are coming up to do an interview with you and Dad."
And I understand that also. There was also a big game this week as well, wasn't there? The Swindon Town under-18s taking on the under-18s side from
Swindon
Indonesia.
Town under-18s were playing an Indonesian under-18s 11 at our ground. The Indonesian side were managed by Dennis Wise and Des Walker.
Wow. So suddenly you've been involved all these years, and then suddenly the world's focus is on Melksham Town this week.
Well, it's certainly, yes, that's right. I mean, it's been, from the publicity point of view, it's been a great few days for the club, because, as I say, most of my time at Melksham was spent down at the old Cunningham, which was a lovely old-fashioned football ground in the centre of town. It's taken a while, but 10, 12 years ago, there was plans to have a new complex in Melksham, and that's where it was going to go. And the council then had to find us somewhere to go. So we've ended up at the new stadium, which we've been there for now 6 years, which is a great facility at the Oakfield Stadium.
So these 2,000 games, that's from your time when you started in 76 as the assistant secretary. Am I right in thinking that you'd been there as a boy as well? Your dad had taken you down to Melksham Town when you were much younger.
Yeah, I mean, the 2000 games are actually, as I said, ones which I've documented and watched for the time since I joined the club in 76.
So, I mean, as a before that time, any idea how many games that you
I wouldn't say, but Dad, I mean, I remember watching the club as a boy, but I haven't got any idea of how many games I watched then.
And how's football changed over that time? You say you're still helping out. You'd be helping out on Saturday. I'd imagine even the turnstiles are slightly different from when you first started.
Oh, we didn't have turnstiles. We've only had turnstiles and such up after the new ground. I mean, down the old ground, there was a couple of sort of wooden sort of what you call shed things. We're by the entrance there. Like a wooden kiosk or place. So certainly a lot different now.
Mm. And
actually, football's changed over the years. It's quicker. Even in non-league level, but I won't say here, because obviously I get a bit frustrated by the way some can be on both sides, where you touch them and they go down. I know it's a completely different game today from what one used to watch years ago.
But you still enjoy it. You still get out there on a Saturday. Yeah? 2,000 games completed then on your list. What's your next target? Is it games? Is it Melksham related? You're not too far off the playoffs there in the Southern League South Division.
No, we're not. There's still a chance of obviously of of the fifth place. I think the first four teams probably are out of reach at the moment, but there's quite a competition going on for fifth place. Obviously, we've had a reasonably good run of three or four games before last Saturday. We always knew it was going to be a difficult game at AFC Tottenham. But we're home to Slimbridge on Saturday, who are bottom, who we beat 2-1 away a couple of weeks ago. But nothing's guaranteed in football. But obviously, you may be aware, our manager is now Mark Collier, who managed Swindon Super Rangers in the FA Cup first round about 12 years ago, and also had success with Chippenham Town. So he's an experienced manager. So we'll just see now. If things go right, we could well be in that playoffs at the end of the season. But if not, I'm optimistic that Mark will build a team for next season and see where it takes us from then.
Yeah, I'm always trying to encourage the younger generations to come through and get involved in non-league football. If any of those are listening, what's the best thing about being involved with your non-league football club?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
I said, what's the best thing about being involved with your non-league football club?
Well, the best thing I've found over the years is in my travels is meeting people from other countries. I've made great friendships over the years, and just that, I suppose, and doing my bit, and I should do my bit until I'm not able to do so.
Well, and hopefully that'll be for many, many more years to come.
Yes, indeed. I mean, if I could say, somebody did ask me the question last Saturday, what's your next target? I said, well, I think I'm 76. I think 3,000 might be pushing it a bit, but maybe God willing, if I'm watching for another 10 years, I might get to 2,500.
And the way they keep squeezing all these extra cup competitions in and extending the league season, who knows?
Well, who knows? That's right. Yeah, but we don't tend to have many good cup runs at the moment. We seem to have a pretty awful record in the FA Cup. We can't seem to get past the preliminary round,
Dave, those records you've got, has anybody ever analysed them, looked at them and sort of put them in a spreadsheet or anything like that? I just wonder whether you've got a good home win record or something like that.
I haven't actually done that. I mean,
there's a school project. There's a school project for somebody.
I know I've watched 1,468 Western League games.
Wow.
Which is, and I think they played about, hang on, I've got it handy here, if you can hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, in their Western League, until they came into the Southern League, they'd played 1,656 games. Of those, I'd watched 1,468. Now, they had two seasons in the Western League before I joined the club in 1976. And I wouldn't have seen any of them games because I was not around at that time.
Wow. So, pretty much, there's
well,
not...
Well, I worked out. I think it's about 86%.
Well, it's no wonder then. I see that you've got another engagement on the 20th of April presenting to the Melksham...
Yeah, that's right. I've got to go and give a talk to the Melksham District Historical Association on the history of the club. And as I say, I have done quite a bit of research on the club, which was formed in 1876. So it is one of the oldest non-league clubs in the country.
Well, I know
it's older than some league clubs.
Indeed, I know. One of my good friends and a good friend of the show, Russell Grant, who's a big football fan, non-league football fan, but also local history fan. I think I could sit you two in a room for weeks on end, and the stories that you could tell. I'd imagine. Have you ever thought about writing that autobiography, Dave? The stories from non-league football.
Well, I had an intention to people pressed me, why don't you write a history of the club? Mm. So I had that in mind, but I've been rather sidetracked in the last, as I said earlier in the interview, I've not watched as many games in the last 2 to 3 years as I would have liked, but because I've got a lady friend in Essex who I knew years ago, and she got in touch with me about 5 years back, so I've been down there a bit because she's, you know, I've had to care for her a bit through a breast cancer situation, so...
Well, and again, it just shows what I always say, that the best people are the people that are involved in non-league football, you know.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've got to be honest, I'll obviously watch the football tonight and all that, but and I've been to league football and all that, but I don't even bother to watch Match of the Day and things like that these days.
Yeah.
I might watch the EFL highlights. I actually am a lifelong Bolton Wanderers supporter, people...
You're hopping all over the country now. The things we learn. Look, Dave, I better let you go. I'm sure you've got more important things to do than be telling me about the 2,000 games that you've been to. But it is a great pleasure to get you on the show, speak to you and hear from you. Hopefully we'll speak to you again in, well, about 1,000 games time.
Okay, so hopefully, God willing, I'll be here.
Thanks for joining us on the Non-League Football Show.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Time then to head on over to Non-League Paper Towers. So welcome back to the Non-League Show. It's editor-at-large at the Non-League Paper, Mr. Matt Bacot. Welcome back, Matt.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
Well, it's another busy week. And can you believe that we're on the countdown to this last week of February? It means everything gets exciting in the world of Non-League. But also, it seems to be just a sad time. Last week, spoke with John Couch and we spoke about the death of Brian Lee, and I know you did a great tribute to him in the paper over the weekend as well. And once again, we start with some sad news: the death of John Motson. He was the voice of a generation of football fans, certainly my generation, but he was also a big non-league advocate. I know whenever I had the chance to meet him, interview him. That new Hereford Newcastle FA Cup tie was what he saw as his sliding doors moment. Whether he was going to become the star he once became, or the bog standard football reporter, and he was always so pleased, and then, you know, showing so much respect back to non-league because of that moment.
Yeah, definitely very sad news, and as you say, someone, yeah, rightly has that title of the voice of football, and he's been that backdrop, provided those words to so many of these, you know, massive moments that, you know, certainly I can remember growing up, and you know, they sort of, even moments before, you know, before I was alive, that, you know, you kind of know that it's him. You know, that's so just recognisable, the voice and the style and everything, and as you say, just this sort of love for football. And I think that's, I've seen, I think there's a documentary on BBC in recent years when he would sort of hung up the mic, and you know, that love and that sort of, you know, passion for the game at all levels, just signing, obviously, you know, his links with Barnet as well, didn't he? And you know, he sort of admire that, because I think sometimes in football, when you're sort of involved in it, it can be things that kind of sort of dumb that out of you a little bit. But, you know, he just sort of, you know, had that love for all parts of the game, all aspects, and was just so well known and respected and loved by so many. And I think I saw something earlier that kind of said, you sort of you didn't know him, but he's one of those people that you feel like you knew him, because of all these moments that he provided. And I remember many years ago being at one of the sort of, you know, evenings with Ricky George, I think it was, as well. And they did an evening at Crawley and regaling all the stories, and just sort of a great kind of character of the game, and will be, as you can see from the outpouring, very sadly missed.
Yeah, and I made a comment on social media that there'll be many a match reporter that will be preparing their stats, you know, either today or tomorrow ahead of this weekend, probably based on the similar template that Motti used to use. And it was always one of those that if you got a glance at Motti's stats and his preparation for the game, it was something to marvel at as a you know, whatever, however many years experience you had as a journalist.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've always admired about, commentators, live commentators, they can sort of reel these things off in the moment, and that is all because of the preparation and the work that they put in the week away from the games that we don't all sort of see and think about. And I think that's that's obviously why he was so great at what he did, is because of that love and that passion for putting all that work in and getting all these interesting stats. And again, just this sort of voice, you turn the TV on and you hear it, you didn't even need to know who was the commentator, you didn't need to come up on the screen, you just knew that it was John Motson. So very sad, and I don't think they don't make them many like him anymore, do they?
They don't. I did also see a comment on social media that there'll probably be a rush on sheepskin coats now. I'm just waiting to see some Instagram pictures of terraces full of sheepskin coats this weekend. It was a legend. He was an icon, and will be sorely missed. Non-league also making some national headlines too again this week for all the wrong reasons. We had the league game between Tamworth and Nuneaton being abandoned on 61 minutes due to crowd trouble again this week, and I know that the club's come out condemning the violence, and they're trying to identify, or I think they have identified the suspect as being passed to the police, and one of the people that were involved in that incident were recovering in hospital, thankfully from the serious injury. But it is I know Mark Harris has done a piece for the paper about the issues that maybe non-league is experiencing now because it's more accessible than the game higher up.
Yeah, obviously very awful scenes to see, and it is becoming one of these, obviously you haven't seen a game's been abandoned like that and kind of that sort of extreme, but there just seems to be more and more issues at the moment. It's quite depressing, that's people going to games of football and behaving that way. And I think it is, as you say, because there's a feeling of no consequences and they can sort of get away with it. And, let's hope that the police do come down very hard on the people here and that people don't kind of get away with it. You say Mark Harris wrote a really interesting piece last week for the paper where he's kind of saying about, the key selling points of non-league football, the lower ticket prices, limited crowd, the fact you can have a beer, it's having this unintended consequence. It is easier to misbehave at grounds and kind of get away with it. And that's that's one of the, in the summer before the season, the FA had a big push to kind of try and tackle this rising problem that we saw last year. And we've obviously covered and talked about on this show kind of some of the issues that clubs have been facing, and banning of under 16s and body cams on volunteers and all this kind of stuff. And it is a big concern. It is a big concern for not just the non-league game, but the whole game in general. And unfortunately, the money and the finances aren't there to put in CCTV and for everybody, and all the training that people need to kind of deal with these incidents. If you're a volunteer going down to Stewart as a non-league game, it's normally kind of just pointing people in the right direction, being on hand for anything, and kind of the perk of it was to get in there and watch the game and watch your club and be giving something back and helping out and being part of something as a volunteer. It's not there to be kind of getting in between groups of idiots who are just a bit intent on causing trouble and don't really care what happens and what the consequences are. They're not there for the football, are they?
No, and it is. I associated so much with the comments that Mark Harris made in that piece over the weekend, because it is things that I've seen at games I've been at, games I've been overseeing, But it is also for non-league as well, and I think Mark would be the first to accept this as well, that it's non-league's problem as well, and non-league people involved in non-league need to act in the right way. I know there might be potential new regulations coming in about stewarding, which may affect us all at non-league. That would be a massive financial implication as well, if that were to come in. That's something else that clubs are going to need to maybe have on their radar and understand. But we also, you know, people at non-league need to behave in the right fashion as well. And we also saw this week the South West Peninsula League game between St Blazings and Bude Town abandoned on, I think it was 66 minutes. There was already been some sin bin incidents, a local derby, I guess, fairly fiery, but player and staff behaviour on the field led to the game being abandoned on 66 minutes after both joint managers for Bude were shown red cards. Disappointing, I think, especially, and obviously that's an ongoing matter now that will be dealt with via the various disciplinary channels, but especially in the week when non-league was given the chance to actually trial these referee body cams to help improve the game for all of us.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there needs to be, well, I don't know a huge amount about that sort of incident, obviously wasn't there, but, you know, generally speaking, managers and players need to, you know, there is a responsibility for how they behave. You know, it's just a game and you want to win, but it's got to be done the right way. And when there's people paying and public in there to see games and kids and things, you know, whether they like it or not, there is an influence that you're having on people around and what I see, especially young kids who, you know, every non-league ground you go to, you always see kids running around and having a nice time, but they will, you know, they will soak in what's kind of going on the pitch as well. Yeah, it's just everyone needs to kind of take a bit of a breather sometimes and kind of work out how would you like to be, I think the FA kind of did a sort of a information video recently where you kind of step back and look at how you're behaving and would you actually really want to be seen that way. And I think there needs to be a bit more of that, and, you know, it's not taking away competitive edge, but that's going far over the line with some of the incidents we're sort of seeing. And, you know, you need to go through the FA website with all the sort of different charges and suspensions that are being handed out to see that there's an issue there as well.
Yeah, and you know, again, going back to that piece, from some of the things that we love about the non-league game is it's family orientated, and, you know, if we've got things going off on the field or in the tunnel or in the change rooms, that's not a good sign. You know, one of the great things this week, it wasn't the greatest game that we watched, but there were the Hayes and Yedding United against Swindon Super Marine game, we had 5-year-old twins celebrating their birthday, cheering on their team. I mean, that's what non-league should be about. We love those little human stories. That, you know, and I guess proving that non-league is human, we also had the postponement up at Southport and Spennymoor due to a defective boiler in the change rooms. You know, I don't know, for some reason it made me smile because it's not being detrimental to non-league, but it was so non-league, and it just shows that we're, you know, non-league clubs are more about the football and about the people than maybe the higher up, which is probably interesting. Leads me on to the big news, I guess, of the week in football. The government's white paper, I say white paper, it's 99 pages that have come out of my printer. I've got the PDF on my phone, on my iPad, and I've read it again. It's on football governance. It's the follow-up to the Fanley review on football governance, the Crouch Report, which was created by former Minister Tracy Crouch, of course. It covers from the top of the game at the Premier League level down to the National League, but no further, which for me is a bit of a concern when we want to keep this level playing field of football. We all play the same game, and what we don't want to be is be left behind by this report.
Yeah, it's sort of picking through it, and that is one of the things that sort of stands out. It's the top five tiers of the English football pyramid, so it goes down to National League Step 1, as we call it. You see all these kind of things we're talking about, elite and grassroots and all this kind of thing. And I think when people talk about grassroots, often they're sort of in their mind including sort of clubs in the National League system. That's not grassroots football. National League system is, you know, the grassroots football is below that. So it kind of gets caught in the middle, sort of borough, a term from sort of Mark Harris, as he often uses, like this, the meat in the middle of the sandwich. So, you know, you've got a lot of clubs in that band, that isn't sort of covered by this. And obviously, there's lots of other things going on within the game generally. But you know, some of it, licensing is already in. That's steps 1 to 4, isn't it? And, you know, there's talk of that. So yeah, I think a lot of it is going to be, you know, how relevant it is to the majority of non-league football will sort of be interested. I think a lot of it's in the devil's in the details, isn't it? Yeah. As it comes,
well,
as you say, it moves forward.
There's lots of things already in the mix. You know, the club program that the FA are implementing and have been implementing and rolling it out even further, trying to help clubs on their sustainability side of things. As you say, the licensing system, the accreditation system for non-league clubs. So probably, actually, non-league are maybe leading the way. But what we don't want is for this separate set of rules to be granted to those above when they're talking about the importance of the pyramid and the importance of heritage. When actually, those clubs and the leagues and the people working much lower down the pyramid are probably that strength of heritage and that strength of history and the strength of the pyramid obviously always comes from the base rather than the top.
Yeah, and you're as strong as your base, aren't you? And the talk of the money, coming down, it's kind of, it's just believe it when you see it, really. The Premier League holds all that power, holds that money, and I've spoken to Mark Harris about it today, and kind of one of the points he sort of made about the Premier League is kind of say one of his criticisms of them is they kind of shout about some of the stuff that they already do, and there is lots of stuff going on. It is going to be interesting to see how it kind of plays out, and that it needs to be to making sure that this is interesting, and it talks about ensuring the long term sustainability of the football pyramid, but doesn't seem to address some of the football pyramid, seems to be quite sort of moved to the side. So very difficult to kind of work out fully what the impact long term is going to be until we kind of see how this next sort of, the next sort of process shakes out, because it's going to take an awful lot of resource, I imagine, to get the independent regulator going.
Yeah, and as ever, some action is better than no action, so that's a good thing. And we're talking about the pyramid and the base. Obviously, this week we also saw that the proposed merger in the southwest is effectively the merger's been abandoned, hasn't it? And I think the Leeds committee are now going to try and set up a new working group to discuss the matter of how the restructure in the southwest of England gets organised now, and which I guess is going to delay further that perfect pyramid being created.
It's not sort of a story I've been covering myself. Everyone of my intrepid reporters, Andy Mitchell, has been all over it and speaking to the relevant leagues. But as you say, it has kind of hit the buffers, and it seems that it's not going to be completely off the table. I think it's sort of just from the timing point of view now of everything that's kind of gone on, it's going away, and as you say, start kind of going back to the beginning and coming up again and getting the right solutions to get into place for the 2024-25 season. There's obviously, it's been acknowledged that the kind of an unintended consequence of the restructure has caused an issue in the southwest with clubs and some of the travelling that they're doing. We've seen clubs take voluntary relegation from the Western League Prem because of that. Because of the travelling they've had to do, so there is an issue, and obviously hasn't been, there's lots of, as we all say, football politics and these kind of things, and it hasn't managed to be resolved. So it's kind of going back to the drawing board a little bit. But it's clear that there's an intention that this will happen eventually. It's just not come to fruition this time around, which is, I think, really disappointing for some people. Some clubs will be frustrated by it, but hopefully it can second time around get through and a resolution can be found and then it can get up and running as soon as possible, because I think everybody will be aware of that time pressure.
Yeah, I think it's like anything. Sometimes you just come up against problems, and they're just sometimes it's just easy to step away and then go back and have a look at it. I guess a bit like an exam question. Sometimes it's just easy to move on to the next question, deal with those, and then come back to them. And as you say, we're at the stage of the season where those that are involved in leagues are probably about to become very, very busy again, and it's maybe best just to take that slight step backwards and reassess and then come back at it, and hopefully with clearer minds and sort of more positivity to get things done. I mean, talking of getting things done, this week the clubs seem to be making changes once again on the managerial front. We've seen Aaron Parkinson step down at Daventry Town after seven seasons. Mask United parted company with Curtis Woodhouse this week after a much shorter spell, but he was looking to turn it around from what I've been monitoring on results there. And we also saw at the weekend, Gary Meakin announced he was going to step down at Beaconsfield at the end of the season in the Southern League. He announced that, I think, on Sunday evening or maybe Monday morning. And by Tuesday, he was relieved of his duties anyway. And I think he'd been in charge since 2017, which is quite a time in the modern era. We also have Jay Lovett. He's come in as the boss at Haywards Heath Town, stepping in after departures of last week of Alex Walsh and Dal Hurley, who'd only been there for 2 months. But of course, Lovett himself parted company with Burgess Hill Town last week, as we covered with John Coucher, who in turn have appointed former Ramsgate manager Matt Longhurst. So if you are a manager and you still want to be a manager, there's plenty of vacancies, and people don't sit around too long twiddling their thumbs.
I think I'm going to listen back to this, Tim, and just write down everything you've said there and just put it as a piece in the paper to wrap up everything that's been happening. And as you say, yeah, it's a...
I keep coming back to
it. It keeps on spinning.
My mobile phone, I've got so many notes alongside certain managers. I mean, Curtis and myself, I think the conversations we've had when he's been at different clubs, I sometimes forget where he is at the moment, and
who's where
it's
when you put them in your phone, you have them down as their club sort of for some reason, you've got their number from somebody and it's got the name of their club next to them, and then you sort of don't ever update it, and
by contrast you've then got the
contacts,
the admin stuff there've been a few secretaries over the years that I've dealt with that have moved from club to club, and then because they're very good administrators and they're in demand, but very rarely do you forget where a secretary is at what club they're involved with, because they don't move around, and it's just weird that we're all part of this non-league family, but it seems that if you're on the playing side, your long-term future is maybe not as secure.
It'll be interesting in a few years' time, the sort of the rise in agents in non-league football. Maybe sort of secretaries will start having agents and start getting touted around for their for different jobs. As you say, you've seen the free-flowing market. There's the one for managers. I've just seen that John Askey is, some of the clubs may have been, would often like to, many sort of job vacancies come off so often linked. John Askey so often linked and in the running, but he's actually gone in at Hartlepool United now, and in League Two, trying to help them to avoid relegation back into non-league. So that's another big name off the market if anybody starts looking to get in the National League in the coming weeks.
And obviously showing once again the strength of non-league, because I did actually see. I try and keep an eye on those clubs that have left non-league recently. I did see some non-league some Hartlepool fans complaining about the position that they're currently in, having had those glory years from finally getting out back into the Football League and then going through a series of managers. So it does show that actually, every week we talk about maybe some instability in non-league, but it's probably more stable, being, as we said, further down the pyramid than further up.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's not come quite as Hartlepool would have hoped. There's some sort of difficult times, and obviously you sort of must look at sort of with envy at some of the other clubs who've kind of gone up and performed much better. But there's a lot to be said for that sort of stability in management, and we're seeing it less and less these days, aren't we?
But we are seeing more and more stable clubs, I guess. We've got that top of the table of the National League. No real change there. With Notts County still, 5 points clear. Wrexham still 2 games in hand. But plenty of goals again this week. I think what County had two four-goal hauls. And last week, John Couch and I were discussing Macaulay Langstaff, the fact that he hit 32 goals last year for Gateshead to secure the National North title. And we were saying, well, this is his first season in the top level of football. And then this week, he's hit five this week to take his total already this season to 32.
I'm going to give you a non-league show exclusive here. Macaulay Langstaff is good at football. He's very good. I went to Notts County on Tuesday night, and there's like this sort of, he works so hard. He works so hard. He puts all that effort in. And when he gets a chance, it's kind of, it's like inevitable that the ball's going to go in. He just has that sort of air around him. I spoke to him afterwards and I said, do you sort of go onto the pitch, like expecting to score? And the way he sort of puts it, he just knows, he expects to get chances, and then it's about him trying to put the ball in the net. But the way Notts County play, I mean, they played Southend the other night. Southend have been on a, you know, for all their off-field issues that they've got, you know, Kevin Mayer and the team are just doing a brilliant job, and they've, they're in the playoff hunt, you know, with all the sort of limitations they've got on them, they can't bring players in because of the transfer embargo. Yeah, but no mugs, and Notts County kind of just absolutely dominated them. They're just really good. They're just a really, really good side. They just move the ball around. They always got players in space, and you can tell how, you know, enjoyable it is for the players to be part of it, and how much the fans are enjoying it as well. And McCoy Langstaff, yeah, went on to 32, two brilliant finishes. Second one particularly as well. On a great counter attack, and they're sort of in that position now where, you know, he obviously is chasing this personal accolade and how many goals he's scoring, and they always talk about, you know, Ricky Minnis 40 from a few years ago when he's at Dover, and but it's interesting that he got taken off on two goals when he was on his hat trick, which so he got one on Saturday, didn't he? And so he could have had two hat tricks in a row, and Luke Williams took him off, Notts County head coach, took him off because there is this bigger picture, there's this bigger prize, and at the moment, the way they're both going, Wrexham and Notts County, they're just sort of knocking off the wind, and they have, as you say, Wrexham have got two games in hand, they're 5 points behind. They've also got a huge showdown on Easter Monday at Wrexham, you know, which is the way it's going at the moment. It's kind of already shaping up into that sort of big title decider. Because these two teams are just far ahead of everybody at the moment. Everybody's saying that same thing. It's kind of, how is it going to be that only one of them definitely goes up? The way it looks at the moment, you kind of, you know, you think, well, they both are more than capable of winning a home semi-final and then winning a final to follow the other up. But as we know, the playoffs just don't work like that, and mad things happen in playoffs. I know they won in the end, but you think about Tranmere the year they finally did get up after losing to Forest Green the year before. They had a player sent off inside 60 seconds, and that can change everything. The way it worked out for Tranmere that day is they were able to find a way to win and beat Bournemouth. But it is those one-off games that kind of make it completely dicey. You're looking at these two teams and talking again to McCauley afterwards. He kind of said, you know, people say, do you wish Wrexham weren't in the league? But I don't see it like that. I think we're both pushing each other. I don't think either of us would be on this points table if it wasn't for the other team, because we're driving each other on and, you know, making sure that we work hard every day. I think you call them, they're both machines. Of course, after saying all this, they both lose on Saturday.
I mean,
I've done a piece. They'll lose. Everyone will lose.
But you make mention of Southend. You know, yes, Southend went to Notts County. I think they had the best defensive record in the National League before that game. They then concede four goals. So they're still, I think they're still the joint with you know, people like Bournemouth, Notts County, and Wrexham, that sort of thing. So there's still. Before the game, I think they conceded, 26 goals in 30 games. They conceded four goals against Notts County, but they're still sixth in the table. So they're one of the strongest teams in the league, but even they, on their day, when it just does seem at the moment, Notts County and Wrexham are just in that groove, aren't they? They're just slotting. And then you then wonder, with that Easter Monday game, when tickets are like gold dust anyway for any Wrexham games at the moment, you know, is it going to be like one of those, is it going to be like Woodstock, where everybody's always talking about that they were there, and actually there weren't that many people there because... Or that there were, you know, a capacity crowd, but it can't be that number of people that are going to be talking about. It will be the game to be at.
It's a bit like Newcastle. It's a bit like Newcastle in the League Cup final on Sunday. I mean, they got about 150,000 in there.
I think I've had 150,000 Newcastle fans ask me if I can get tickets.
yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot on social media people begging for tickets for their big game on Sunday. But yeah, it's going to be like that, and those tickets are going to be like gold dust, and there was still quite a few games to be played before then. It will be fascinating to see where it is, and say Wrexham have got those games in hand, and it's just kind of crazy how many points, you know, for Notts County, what they're on, are they on 83 points at the moment?
88 goals scored.
83 points, and there's still 12 games left. It's just, you know, madness. And obviously, Wrexham on 70. They're on 78 now, aren't they? It's just crazy. I did a piece a few weeks ago talking about some of the clubs who got over 90 points and didn't get promoted. Wrexham being one of them, when they got 98 when the year Fleetwood went up. Kiddy got 95 one year, and you know, it's just sort of unimaginable, really, that one of them could both get over 100 points, and then one of them might not go up because of the plan. You know, we all know the rules before it all goes into the season. But you know, it feels like we're edging closer to three up, three down. But that doesn't help either of them this season, because if it was three up, then they'd both be basically home and hose and just fighting out for the title. And you know, without, it's going to make for a gripping few weeks, because it does feel like, you know, who blinks first kind of situation, really.
Yeah. So you've got a fantastic interview with Macaulay Langstaff coming up in this weekend's paper. Anything else we can expect to read?
Well, talking of goals, I've also caught up with a lad who's dealt in goals over the years for lots of different clubs like Matlock and Chester and Grimsby and... which is Ross Hanna. He scored, I think it was a few years ago, he scored 52 for Matlock in one season. That got him his move to Bradford City. And, he's 36 now, but still going strong. He's playing step six at Rossington, Maine, in the Northern Counties East League. And they've got a big game against, their second at the moment, they've got a big game against Campion on Saturday. But I thought it was time to catch up with Ross. And he sort of said, I thought you'd never call, because he's just scored three hat-tricks in a row. So nine in his last three games, three trebles and a trot.
Has he got an extra house that he just keeps all these footballs in when he's got? He sort of collects a football after his hat trick and things like that, and his golden boots.
Well, this is it. And I said to him, because it reminded me of the year when he was at Matlock. I think that year he got the 52. It's one of the sort of first times I spoke to him. It must have been about sort of 2010 or 11, or maybe not even 2009. He scored seven in a game and followed that up with a hat trick. So I kind of said that nine in three is not quite as good as his 10-2 from back then. But I remember we sent down a photographer down to Matlock's training, in like a sports hall. And the idea was that we'd get the seven, because he scored seven in the game, we'd get seven match balls, seven balls around him. And Matlock didn't actually have as many as seven match balls in training. And we actually had to Photoshop some in. There you go, I've let a big secret there. Oh. Yeah. We had to Photoshop some extra balls into the photo, because we sort of gave the photographer, oh, they didn't have enough balls in there, sort of four or five. So, but yeah, quite over us, and it's one of those interesting ones where he's kind of saying, you know, he admits, you know, he's a little bit worried about dropping down to step six, but he's there, he's really enjoying it, he's enjoying playing football and enjoying trying to win games and enjoying the ball going in the back of the net. And kind of says, you know, makes him feel like when he was back at Matlock and you know, when he was young, and just that enjoyment for football and that thrill on a Saturday of getting out there with your mates and having a good go and trying to get the ball in the back of the net, which he's doing quite regularly.
It sounds another interview well worthy of my time on Sunday morning. But Matt Badcock, I better let you go because there's probably various other bits and pieces you've got to prepare for the non-league paper this weekend. Thanks as ever for all your help, and we'll speak to you again very soon.
Thanks, Tim. Speak soon.
Thanks as ever then to all of you for listening. That is the end of the show. We'll make one quick mention of my nephew Hugo, at the age of 14, submitted and his first match report for Portishead Town at the weekend. First match report in print, very proud, and hopefully a lengthy career ahead of him, and hopefully many more that will follow down the same path that I travelled. If anybody wants to take on the mantle, that's a great way to follow. Thank you then to all of my guests. Thank you for everybody for listening. Remember, you can of course follow us throughout the season and join in throughout the week on social media at Non-League Show. Myself there, Tint Fuel. FUELL, and you can follow us every week on Audio Boom, on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Castbox, iHeart, Geo7, Listen Notes, Overcast, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Radio Republic, via your smart speakers and all good podcast aggregation sites. Stay safe, enjoy your football. Thank you, and goodbye.
Jibber Jabber Production. JIBBA JABBA.